Hello, this is Jürgen, and this is the podcast on effective altruism. Effective altruism. So I will present what is the plan, what is the outline, what is the roadmap. I will present deliberations on the traditional philosophy concept of altruism, categorical imperative, utilitarianism. The objective is an evaluation of the current movement, effective altruism, a movement asks ethical questions like, should you give money to charities? Should you give money to disaster relief? Should you buy fair trade goods? Should you buy goods that are produced in a sweatshop? Should you offset your carbon dioxide emissions to prevent harm? How should money, how much money should the state spend on overseas development aid? Okay, so the evaluation is the assessment, is the objective is the assessment, the evaluation of this current movement. And I will do the assessment using traditional philosophical concepts. Okay, so we'll see the answers the movement gives to these questions. We will see how the movement, how you can view the movement in light of the traditional concept. So effective altruism, the main noun is altruism. So what are the origins of altruism? In a world that became, in a modern world that became individualistic, altruism arose as a way to think about it, think about the world. Altruism asks us to focus on the other. Altruism asks us to give attention to others' needs. Altruism supports a kind attitude to others. It supports benevolence. How our philosophical ideas about altruism responded to the dramatic rise of evolutionary Darwinian theory. Charles Darwin, the English naturalist, left us with a puzzle. How do we explain that humans are so kind to others? The background of the question is the idea, the Darwinian concept of the survival of the fittest. Survival in the natural world is important because it gives humans a chance to reproduce. The puzzle or dilemma is that the performance of a benevolent or altruist act imposes a cost on one and help others to survive who compete with us. Hence the intellectual challenge, our first challenge, is the statement, humans are too good, too nice, and too emphatic. The second challenge is that there are social instincts. The second challenge is that they are social insects. For Darwinian thought, the natural state is egoism, care for ourselves, not altruism, care for others. Hence, Darwinian thought needs to explicate altruism. The modern resolution of the intellectual problem is that the gene carries information from generation to generation, and the gene is selfish. a catchy phrase. Selfish genes may or may not lead to our care for A, our relatives, or B, reciprocators. That is, persons who respond to kind acts with kind acts and to nasty acts with nasty acts. Our ancestors did grow up in small villages in which kindness paid off. Today, in our great cities, we still use, or we seem to use, small village rules of thumb, like be nice, in which we interact with strangers. David Hume, the famous philosopher, the famous Scottish philosopher, distinguishes between natural and artificial, that is, social virtues. According to Hume, natural are, for instance, our emotions, and natural is benevolence. For instance, sympathy is natural, our capacity to feel someone's pain. The concept of natural virtues means that we naturally have these virtues and we naturally admire those virtues. According to Hume, our emotions become moral when we correct for proximity, that is, when we adjust for A, our personal connections, and B, the here and now. Consider now the following two examples and the corresponding statements expressing human thought. A. 1. It is natural to visit a friend. 2. It is moral to visit a stranger in hospital. Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, the famous German philosopher, has a rational perception of duty. Kant encourages us to think for ourselves. Kant is a thinker of the age of enlightenment. According to Kant, something is moral because of duty. Something is moral because it is binding. So I repeat, according to Kant, something is moral because of duty. Something is moral if it is binding. These thoughts we will see imply that Kant must call for a strong commitment to altruism. More details below. John Stuart Mill, the English philosopher, the famous English philosopher, writes about utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is a moral theory that emphasizes ends over means. Utilitarianism holds that a good act is one that increases pleasure in the world and decreases pain. The tradition flourished in the 8th and 19th centuries with Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. According to Bentham, happiness is a measure for assessing the utility of an act, declaring it is the greatest happiness of the greatest number that is the measure of right and wrong. This concept is known as the greatest happiness principle. An open question for utilitarianism, a still open question, is what kind of pleasures are to be considered. Is there a system of pleasures? Is there a hierarchy of pleasures? Are only bodily pleasures considered? Are pleasures only positive sensory stimulations? are pleasures essentially a relief from pain? Are luxuries like chocolate merely a variation on pleasure? Are pleasures mental as well? Is the enjoyment of past and future pleasures a pleasure as well? Utilitarianism has antecedents in ancient philosophy. Epicurus supports hedonism. Epicurus believes that reasons are means for achievement of a tranquil life. Epicurus believes that friendship is a source of mental pleasure. Epicurus believes that there is no afterlife, hence there is hence no reward for good action and there is no retribution for bad action. Epicurus focused on inward goals. He searches for ways to help people attain a happy and tranquil life. He does not focus on goals of the collective. In contrast, Plato focuses on the good of the collective. Utilitarianism had been considered a modern theory of good and wrong because it had been arguing against ancient practices. It had been arguing against ancient practices for retribution and punishment. Punishment is pain inflicted on others. Historic examples of the consequences of the powerful forces, retribution and punishment, are the Punic Wars that ended with the destruction and abandonment of the great city of Carthage. The description of utilitarianism is useful because it makes it plain that the greatest happiness principle asks us to evaluate actions by their consequences. It calls for a strong commitment to altruism in which everyone is treated equally. Nowadays, there is a great good debate on the distinction between act utilitarianism and rule utilitarianism. Recall that Hume says that the source of our action, our passion. In contrast, recall that Mill argues that the cause of our action, the source of our action, should be the assessment of the greatest happiness. Kant argues that happiness cannot be the source, cannot be the basis of our deliberations. Why? We tend to compare us to others. If others do better than we, we become miserable. Perhaps it's worthwhile to spend more time on Kant. What we want to do when talking ethics is to tell right from wrong. We want to do that by appealing to the concepts of reason and rationality. The source of the decision is our deliberation. We want to do something right if it's a universal law. Hence, we must be searching for something that is unconditional, for something that is constant, for something that is empirical. A candidate is a will. The will gives rise to intentions. Intentions give rise to actions. We look inward, searching inward. We are looking for a source in us. We are looking for a categorical imperative. We are looking for reasons, for the right reasons. We are looking for something we could decide on principle. Thinking through things rationally gives us motivation for actions. Consider Kant's famous example, shopkeeper's pricing, torture, promise, help others. Consider Kant's famous examples. First, shopkeeper's pricing. Two, torture. Three, promise. Four, help others. In short, Kant's categorical imperative asks the question, can we will that as a universal law? Can we will that as a universal law? The argument, if you want, the rational, the check of consistency has to be that we are not led to a contradiction. So it's a rational argument. Note that the categorical imperative is different from the golden rule. The golden rule says help no one. The golden rule could say help no one. That rule would be okay, but not for Kant. Note that hypothetical imperatives have if-then statements. Statements like if it rains and if you want to stay dry, then use an umbrella. Categorical imperatives are must-do statements that have reference to obligations. Kant presents various formulations of the categorical imperative, the universal law of nature. Kant's first formulation, called the universal law of nature, states that you are to act only in accordance with that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it become a universal law. I'm repeating, this is universal law of nature. It states that you are to act only in accordance with that maxim so which you can at the same time will that it become a universal law. The decision procedure has steps, four steps. First, formulate a maxim that enshrines your reason for acting as you propose. Second, rewrite that maxim as a universal law governing everyone. All must act as you propose to act in these circumstances. Third, consider whether your maxim is even conceivable in a world governed by this law. Fourth, ask yourself whether you could rationally will to act on your maxim in such a world. If you could, then your action is morally permissible. Hence, if your maxim passes all four steps of the procedure, only then is acting on it morally permissible. I repeat, hence, if your maxim passes all four steps of the procedure, only then is acting on it morally permissible. Kant uses examples to demonstrate that every kind of duty can be derived from the categorical imperative. Kant uses examples also to bolster his case that the categorical imperative is indeed a fundamental principle of morality. Consider the third example. Consider the maxim to refrain from making promises you have no intention in keeping. I want to argue that this is a duty towards others. I will briefly sketch one way of arguing that it's a duty to others to refrain from lying promises. Suppose you consider making a promise but have no intention of keeping it in order to get money. Being rational requires not contradicting oneself. I will show that there's a contradiction in the maxim. I will make lying promises when I achieve something I want. First, note that the immoral action itself, your deceptive promise, clearly does not involve a contradiction. It is rational to perform the action. Kant's position is that it is irrational to perform an action if that action's maxim contradicts itself once made into a universal law. Hence, I must prove that the maxim of lying, whenever it gets you what you want, generates a contradiction once you try to combine it with the universalized version that all rational agents must lie when doing so gets them what they want. Here's a proof. Remember that my maxim is to make a deceptive promises in order to get money. It is necessary that someone might take my word and I take advantage of their doing so. I must assume that it is widely known that no such practice of giving one's word could exist. So I am conceiving of a world in which everyone knows that no practice of giving one's word exists. However, I also conceive a world in which everyone must try to deceive people anytime. Thus, in trying to conceive of my maxim in a world in which no one ever takes anyone's words in such circumstances and knows this about one another, I'm trying to conceive of this. A world in which no practice of giving one word exists, but also at the same time, a world in which just such a practice does exist for me to make use of the maxim. It is a world containing my promise and a world in which there can be no promises. Hence, it is inconceivable that I could act on my maxim in a world in which my maxim is a universal law of nature. Hence, it is inconceivable that these two things exist together. I am forbidden ever to act on the maxim of lying to get money. I will present the second formulation of the categorical imperative, the humanity formulation. We should never act in such a way that we treat humanity, whether in ourselves or in others, as a means only, but always as an end in itself. Ooh. This statement introduces the idea of respect for persons, for whatever it is that is essential to our humanity. So the humanity formula says, we should never act in such a way that we treat humanity, whether in ourselves or in others, as a means only, but always as an end in itself. This statement introduces the idea of respect for persons, for whatever it is that is essential to our humanity. Intuitively, there seems something wrong with treating human beings as mere instruments with no value beyond this. What the humanity formula roots out is engaging in this use of humanity in such a way that we treat humanity as a mere means to our ends. For instance, the difference between a horse and a taxi driver is not that we may use one but not the other as means of transportation. Unlike the horse, the humanity of a taxi driver must at the same time be treated as an end in itself. It is not human beings per se, but the humanity in human beings that must be treated as an end in itself. What is that humanity? Our humanity is that collection of features that makes us distinctively human. These features include abilities to engage in self-directed rational behavior and to adopt and pursue our own ends. Thus, we suppose that the taxi driver has freely exercised her rational capacities in pursuing her line of work. We make permissible use of these abilities as a means only if we behave in a way that she could when exercising her rational capacities, consent to, for example, by paying an agreed on price. Humanity is in the first instance an end. It is something that limits what I may do in pursuit of my other ends. Insofar As it limits my action, it is a source of duty. Now, many of our ends are subjective in that we are not ends, that they are not ends that every rational being must have. Humanity is an objective end because it is an end that every human being must have. Hence, the humanity of others limits what I am morally permitted to do, what I am morally permitted to do when I pursue my ends. The humanity is also an end as something to be produced by my actions. Humanity must be cultivated, developed, and fully actualized. Hence, the humanity in oneself is a source of a duty to perfect one's humanity. Insofar as humanity is positive, insofar as humanity is a positive end in others, I must attempt to further their ends. In doing so, I further humanity in others by helping further the ends that they have willingly adopted for themselves. The third formulation of the categorical imperative, the alternative form, is the idea of the will of every rational being as a will that legislates universal law. That is, act so through your maxims you could be a legislator of human laws. This formulation sounds similar to the first formulation, the universal law of nature. However, in this case, I focus on my status as a lawgiver, as a universal lawgiver, rather than universal law follower. What is the objection to the universal law of nature formulation? A rational will that is merely bound by universal laws could. What is the objection to the universal law of nature's formulation? A rational will that is merely bound by universal laws could act accordingly from motives such as self-interest. But in order to be a legislator of universal laws, such contingent motives, motives that rational agent such as ourselves may or may not have, must be set aside. Hence, we are required, according to the autonomy formula, to conform our behavior to principles that express this autonomy of the rational will. It is its status as a source of universal law that obligates us. I repeat, hence we are required, according to the third formulation of the categorical imperative, according to the autonomy formula, to conform our behavior to principles that express this autonomy of the rational will. Its status as a source of the universal law that obliges us. So effective altruism answers the question, should you give money to charities? Should you give money to disaster reliefs? By arguing that you should invest money where you get the most bang for the buck. Right? So you should not give money to charities in developed countries. You should not give money to cancer research in developed countries. You should not give money to disaster reliefs. You should not buy fair trade goods. You should buy goods that are produced in a sweatshop. You should offset your carbon dioxide emissions to prevent harm. You should not offset your carbon dioxide emissions to prevent harm. How much money should the state spend on overseas development aid? What is a rational? So a rational is to look at cost benefits of actions, weighting cost benefits. You compare the benefits of your donation, say, the measure is, the metric is quality adjusted life years, bang for the bucks. So you compare your donation to one charity with a donation to another charity, and you should invest your money, you should give money to the charity which saves more lives, saves more life years, saves more quality adjusted life years. But you get the most benefit for the buck. Right? So the movement is focusing on poverty. Poverty is a threat to lives, to life years, to quality adjusted life years. Political change is blocked by vested interests. Political change is about causes. Yeah, we should treasure what we measure. We should treasure money and time. We should not be driven by emotions, by what is sexy. Yeah, so we have to check outcomes. We have to check whether outcomes are good. Feedback is important. How do we check outcomes? First, we will ask how many people will be affected? What are the improvements in people's lives? We are searching for the most effective intervention, using a spreadsheet, using cost-benefit analysis, cold, rational cost-benefit analysis, which is not emotional. If you think about a situation where you are entering a burning house and you can either save a life of a child or a piece of art, a Picasso, prestigious, expensive piece of art by Picasso, then you should save the Picasso. It is clear from this consideration that effective altruism is a form of utilitarianism. It rejects Hume's approach, who argued that we are driven by our emotions. It rejects the role of emotions. Yeah. Effective altruism is arguing against Hume's approach. No? It is arguing against Kant's approach. Kant argued that happiness cannot be the source. Cannot be the basis of our moral consideration. This concludes our podcast.